Seekers. Hey, Mike Malloy here. Hope you had a great day. Welcome to the campfire tonight. Hope you stick around for a while. I'm not prepared to talk about health care insurance reform tonight, but I just spent the better part of the last hour listening to Oberman. His entire program tonight was one of his so-called special comments, and it was astonishing. I don't think I've seen television like that. Or commentary like that, ever. And, Rachel Maddow followed up. Her program's on now if you live in the East and the Central time zones. Regarding what he had to say, this won't make sense if you didn't see it, but regarding what he had to say, I'll be signing up at, the website he's going to set up soon to accomplish what he talked about. Now, how do you find out about this? Just listen to the rebroadcast of Overman's program, which here in the East will be in an hour, I believe. It's okay. You can go. It's extremely, or TiVo, whatever, tape it. Or I don't mean tape it. Record it. The entire hour that he devoted, and the plan that he has is, one of the more well thought out, actions taken for any issue, but especially for the reforming of health care insurance in this country that I've ever heard, ever, from anybody. If this was Oberman's plan on his own, he is an absolute genius. This is a guy who should be doing exactly what he's doing, I guess. All right, so if you didn't see Oberman's program, please check it out. The rerun comes up in an hour here in the East. And if you want to hang with me, then just like I said, record it, do whatever you have to do. But I think it's very important. My focus tonight, at least during this first segment, is on Afghanistan again. I've spent the better part of today going about my business, my normal day, and. Realizing, of course, because in traveling about today, I've spent a lot of time listening to Sirius satellite radio, some of their NPR channels, some of the debate, also listen to a bit of CNN, although it's getting more and more difficult to do that, about the decision or decisions that Barack Obama is going to be making here in the next couple, 3 weeks. In addition, this issue of The Nation arrived in my mailbox today. So their lead editorial, which I'll be sharing with you here a little bit later, also focused on this question of what to do about Afghanistan. And in thinking about this today and spending an awful lot of time thinking about it today, not talking to Kathy about it, not discussing it with anybody, not, making a big deal about it, not blogging about it, just thinking about it in my own head, I'm left with something that is fairly shocking to me, I guess. I guess shocking in its simplicity. And the question that's been rattling around in my head is, on what moral basis are we involved in Afghanistan? What moral basis? I'm not talking about politics, geopolitics or globalization or corporatism. I'm just talking about you and me because it's... ultimately going to be our responsibility to pay for it in terms of the people that we send to die, the Americans that we send to die. It is also our responsibility to fully accept the responsibility of waging war against a people who have done nothing to us and cavalierly referring to their deaths and maimings as collateral damage. If there is not a moral dimension to our continuing occupation and war in Afghanistan, then do we not have to withdraw? One of the stories getting awful lot of attention today is a Supreme Court case involving a cross out in the desert, the Mojave National Preserve in California. It was erected by the Veterans of Foreign Wars 70 years ago. For the past decade, it's been the focal point of a dispute over the government's decision to allow this Christian symbol on federal lands. The Supreme Court heard arguments on this issue today. And the issue of morality there is fairly clear, I think. The issue dates to 1999 when the feds rejected a request by a Buddhist group to erect a shrine near the cross. The government stated at the time that it was intending to remove the cross anyway. Congress reacted by forbidding the use of federal funds to take down the cross, and followed up the next year by designating the structure and immediately surrounding property a national memorial in honor of the war dead. This is religious corruption at its worst. War dead for this country in all of our attacks against other people have included atheists, Jews, Christians of various denominations, probably a Buddhist or two who was conscripted. I would imagine some Muslims have died in defense of this country's stories that we are there for, you know, mom, the flag, and apple pie. All of these various people who were of various religions and who are now dead, I don't think they really gave a tinker's damn as they were sucking in their last breath as to whether or not a religious symbol was going to be placed on federal land somewhere out in California. The point being that the absence of morality in our stance where it concerns Afghanistan is magnified, I think, by this argument about a cross, a symbol of Christianity. The people defending this cross, this Christian symbol, the people, and I saw a lot of them on television today with their defiant statements, in absolute disrespect and disregard of both the Constitution and people who do not happen to recognize the cross as a symbol that they recognize it to be. I heard statements of defiance and statements veiled threats about what will happen if that symbol of the religion were to come down. And of course, and again, you know, my question always about this sort of issue is I would defend with my last breath the right to somebody to erect a cross on their own property. Forever, or a Star of David, or a Muslim crescent, or a statue of the Buddha. Truly, if the authorities ever marched on to a person's property who had erected a cross and said, take it down, I would be one of the first there in all my atheistic neutrality with a rifle to say, I'll stand with you if the government tries to make you, a private citizen, remove this cross from your private property. But that's not the issue. That's not the issue here. So since there seems to be this faux morality being presented, I listened to the audio of some of the arguments, or the questions, I should say, coming from the Supreme Court justices, who seem very hostile to the idea of removing this religious symbol. The issue is not anything other than respect for the Constitution. And for the people who are claiming a moral high ground on this, where is that claim where it concerns Afghanistan? Today marks 8 years. This is now the third longest armed conflict we have been involved in. Vietnam, the Civil War, and now this. Was it the Civil War or Revolutionary War? I think it was the Civil War. And now this bloodletting that's going on in Afghanistan. Where is the morality to validate what we are doing? We are killing people in Afghanistan who have done nothing. They're trying to live their lives. We will not succeed in what the official story is as to our reason for being there. There is no way that it's going to succeed. So where is the morality to continue the killing? Portion of the Mike Malloy program is brought to you by It's Up to Us Alone, featuring Ed Asner. Go to usalone.com for information on where to hear the debut of this dramatic new radio play in your area. It's 21 past the hour. So this is the issue that dominated my interior dialogue today. Or interior monologue was where do we find a moral position for this continuing slaughter in Afghanistan? And the questions that are being raised about not just continuing it, but escalating it. Barack Obama has been pretty much presented with a demand for an additional 40,000 troops, which would bring our commitment to Afghanistan to over 100,000 soldiers. Now, for those of us over a certain age, we've seen this before. We saw this before. And I'll be a son of a bitch if hundreds of thousands of us didn't try to prevent it 40 years ago. Exactly the same thing. Do we never reach a point in this country where we learn by what we have done in the immediate past, where we take a look at the political aspect of an invasion and occupation, the blood aspect of the killing aspect, and eventually get to the money aspect, the part of this that involves ethical conduct or morality? Do we get to that issue? Are we to never discuss the killing and the invasion and the war making that we're involved in from a moral standpoint? Does it always have to be some sort of geopolitical balance sheet? We all know, those of us who still have a brain left, all know that there is nothing that we are fighting for in Afghanistan that can be reduced or elevated, take your pick, to the rational reasons for a just war. There is nothing there. And the term just war itself is madness. What is a just war? You know, Bush's invasion of this country 8 years ago was an exercise in his idiocy, his incompetence, his inability to see anything other than as a nail, because George W. Bush always saw himself as a hammer. And now we have Barack Obama. And I don't care how much of a blank slate he craftily presented to those of us who supported him. This man has an obligation from a moral standpoint to stop this. I don't give a damn what a Stanley McChrystal says. He is nothing. He's a war lover. I don't care what Eric Cantor says about, well, if the president supports General McChrystal, we'll support him. Cantor, sit down and shut up. You have nothing to say that has any basis in reality. So here, I mean, the list is endless of these war lovers. Cowards all. None of these sons of bitches are ever going to put on a uniform and pick up a weapon and go slog through the mountains of Afghanistan, killing or being killed. It's not going to happen. Where is the morality? That's all. It's a simple question for me. There has to be. You know, I get so sick of listening to these phony-ass religious people. I get tired of the Christians. I get tired of the Jews. I get tired of the Muslims. I am so over all of you with your God justifications for lies and deceit and occupations and murder and mayhem and Nazi-like actions and invasions and bombings and mortarings and killing. Screw you all. I really, truly wish you would go away, but you're not going to, are you? I like to hear just one of the war lovers or the war supporters or these great religious freaks with their avatars who talked about peace and love and balance and salvation and redemption and confession and justify this from a moral standpoint. You cannot. You cannot. But some of you will get your bowels in an uproar about a cross sitting in the Mojave Desert someplace on federal land. Oh, well, we're not going to let that come down. But it's in violation of the Constitution. Is it really impossible for this country, the United States of America, any longer, if we ever did, to take a moral position on any issue? I don't care if it's health care or the invasion of another country or supporting the occupation that one country is forcing on another, whatever the issue is. Is it impossible for us to take a moral stance any longer? Is it? Before the hour. I think I have the answer to my own rhetorical question. As far as a moral aspect to anything in this country anymore, on a basis of coming from any branch of governing, I just am convinced that it doesn't exist anymore. There may be some efforts where it concerns environmental issues that are starting to resurface in the Obama administration because we don't, for example, have a former lobbyist for the lead industry running the EPA now. But as far as morality, where it concerns globalized anything, whether it's foreign policy or economics or monetary policy, whatever, no. And I don't know that there ever was. But It raises an issue for me that if there is not a moral dimension to an issue, then the issue ultimately is a failure. If it may succeed in a manner of speaking insofar as a strategy is concerned, but insofar as whether or not it is good, a good thing, and we do make judgments, don't we? If there is no moral aspect, then it is not a good thing. This horror of Afghanistan that is going to apparently escalate. I don't believe at this point that Barack Obama I would love in 2 weeks to come on this program embarrassed and shameful and say I was wrong, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't believe Barack Obama is going to do anything but escalate. And doing nothing is an escalation. Just allowing things to continue as they are is an escalation, because it means an escalation in the number of dead people, Americans and Afghans, and other people who are involved in what is essentially our invasion. So doing nothing constitutes an escalation, because it means there will be more death, more destruction, more people coming home to this country with hideous injuries, both physical and emotional. Yesterday, the staff at Truthout takes basically the same position. They write, yesterday the Senate passed $128 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This appropriation could fuel a surge in deployment of U.S. troops to Afghanistan. General Stanley McChrystal recommends an increase of up to 40,000 soldiers. If the American people had voted on this latest defense spending bill, they might well have rejected the funding. Most polls find that a definitive majority of Americans oppose an escalation of combat troops in Afghanistan. A recent McClatchy survey found that only 35% favored sending more troops. This widespread public skepticism is understandable given the war's mounting fatality rate. President Obama has lately shown well-warranted caution in preparing to deploy more U.S. troops and remains wary of McChrystal's call for a quick escalation. Still, Obama has not wavered in his support for the war. Less than 2 months ago, the president said, quote, if left unchecked, the Taliban insurgency will mean an even larger safe haven from which al-Qaeda would plot to kill more Americans. So this is not only a war worth fighting, this is fundamental to the defense of our people, end quote. Obama. In the lead up to last year's election, we, the staff at Truthout, we hoped that Obama's hawkish rhetoric on Afghanistan was simply a savvy campaign choice intended to capture the votes of so-called moderates who feared the prospect of a soft-on-terror commander-in-chief. Now we wonder whether Obama has succumbed to his own warlike words. Truthout calls on the Obama administration and Congress to embrace a firm shift in mindset and engage in the critical thinking necessary to end the war by peaceful means. How to prompt this transformation? Last month, Congressman Dennis Kucinich suggested a logical first step toward halting the military machine in Afghanistan, cutting its purse strings. Kucinich said then, quote, if the Obama administration refuses to bring this war to an end, then Congress should use the power of the purse granted by the Constitution to end the war and bring our troops home, end quote. President Obama has called the Afghan conflict a war of necessity. We entreat Congress and the administration to reframe the official story on Afghanistan and reveal the true necessity at hand to stop funding directionless violence and bring the troops home. An edited version of the editorial staff at truthout.org. Dennis Kucinich's plea of turning off or cutting off the purse strings, if taken by to a vote on the House floor, would probably gather three or four votes. We all know that. One of which would be Kucinich's. This is where we are in this country. I deeply appreciate Kucinich's refusal to give in to this this craziness. But the American people have absolutely no influence on the other 434 members of Congress to do what Kucinich is suggesting. We don't have a say any longer in these issues. We do not. The say will be had by those who profit from war. That's all. I mean, that's how obvious does it have to be? You all are smart enough to know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You know this. The nation takes this position, in the next few weeks, Barack Obama will make a decision that will define his presidency. Will he escalate the war in Afghanistan, sending 40,000 additional U.S. soldiers to reinforce the 68,000 already there? To engage in an open-ended, nation-building, counterinsurgency mission? Or will he redefine U.S. objectives and ask his advisors to craft an alternative strategy? Two events intended to bolster the case for the former: more troops. Afghanistan's August 20th presidential election and General Stanley McChrystal's August 30th assessment of the war have instead demonstrated the wisdom of the latter to get out. Opponents of escalation now include conservative columnist George Will, who editorialized in favor of withdrawal in the September 1st Washington Post, as well as Senators Richard Durbin, Russ Feingold, Carl Levin, chair of the Armed Services Committee. Meanwhile, Senators Dianne Feinstein, Jack Reed, and John Kerry, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, have weighed in with pointed skepticism about the cost in terms of escalation. Afghanistan's recent election revealed the fraud, corruption, and unpopularity of the U.S.-backed regime there. But it is McChrystal's report that raises the gravest doubts. And I might add, from me, not the nation, I think McChrystal raised these doubts wholly unintentionally, because he's blind. He's a war lover. Back to the nation. Although it maintains, the report maintains that, quote, success is still achievable, end quote, the daunting challenges it identifies should lead foreign policy realists to conclude the exact opposite. Among the obstacles McChrystal's report cites are, quote, the weakness of state institutions, the widespread corruption and abuse of power, a crisis of confidence among Afghans, the growing influence of insurgent groups backed by narco-trafficking and or the Pakistani government, and the operational culture of foreign forces there, which poorly understand Afghan social, political, economic, and cultural affairs. McChrystal plans to integrate U.S. troops into Afghan units. With this strategy, he concludes it, quote, is realistic to expect that Afghan and coalition casualties will increase. Are Americans willing to pay that price? What is the goal of a counterinsurgency mission? How will so-called victory be measured? For now, the administration should be pushed hard to explain the purpose and logic of increasing U.S. involvement. Until it does, any escalation has failed the very test Obama established. Quote, absolute clarity about what the strategy is going to be. And John Saltz, the head of VoteVets.org and an Iraq War veteran, released the following statement on the anniversary at the beginning of the war in Afghanistan. Have I got time to do this? I don't. All right. It's very quick, but our military affairs correspondent sent this to me. I'll share it with you when we come back. And then I want to give you a couple of websites where you can participate in action or get information about action against Obama and McChrystal and the Republicans and the Democrats and the corporatists' insistence that morality has nothing to do with anything and the killing has to continue. We'll be right back.
He's the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Well, by the way, a couple of people have written to me. You don't have to leave here in about 10 minutes and watch Oberman. MSNBC.com has free video and audio podcasts of Countdown and Rachel's program. Video of Oberman's special comments are always available. That's from Jamie in Maryland. And Sheila says the transcript will be all over the web tomorrow as well as on MSNBC.com. So you don't have to. I just think it's very important to hear what Oberman had to say in his the entire program was a special comment regarding health care. John Soltz is the head of VoteVets.org. He's an Iraq War veteran who works for the end of this particular war, but war in general. He issued a statement saying, quote, after eight long years in Afghanistan, progress has been all too slow and losses way too high. We honor and remember all those who lost their lives, all those who were wounded, and all those families who have had to bear the burden of their loved one being in harm's way in service to America. At the same time, today is a reminder that we have yet to get the strategy right in this war, and the current course is untenable. It is our hope that the president carefully weighs all the options being presented to him and makes some quick decisions on how we can clearly define and achieve success in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. Most importantly, after 8 years of eroding public confidence in our efforts there, President Obama needs to explain his decision to the American people and rally the American people to the cause. And, of course, the cause, in my opinion, is to withdraw. Now, what you can do, there's some actions you can take to demand a sensible policy from this administration. You can go to the War Resisters League. It is warresisters.org. They've been around forever. Warresisters.org. They're organizing protests on October 5th in Washington and October 7th in New York. What's the date today? That's already passed. Yeah, that's right. Today was, I haven't heard a thing about it. Warresisters.org. Go to the to their website. A website. Come on, Mike. Try English. Peace Action organization is helping activists nationwide organize out of Afghanistan house parties. Their website is peaceforafghanistan.org. House parties where hosts can screen Robert Greenwald's new documentary, Rethink Afghanistan, and bring together citizens for a discussion of the future of U.S. involvement there. Now, you can watch the video yourself, the entire movie, Robert Greenwald's movie. It's available online. It is at rethinkafghanistan.org, I believe. Is that, .com. rethinkafghanistan.com. The entire film is there. The video is there. It's in six parts. And so attending a house party where you invite people over is a good idea, but you can also do this on your own. Code Pink is collecting signatures for a petition on the Women Say No to War portion of its website. You can go to Code Pink for Peace. And that's numeral 4, CodePink, numeral 4, peace.org. MoveOn is calling on its more than 5 million members to email the president, demand a plan to get troops out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. You can go there, MoveOn.org. And on the night of the anniversary, that is tonight, the American Friends Service Committee and United for Peace and Justice have organized candlelight vigils across the country to demand dialogue and development in Afghanistan instead of just more foreign troops. And on the West Coast, those candlelight vigils will begin, I'm sure, momentarily. So there are actions that we can take that do not involve showing up for a 500,000 person march in Washington. someone made the argument to me the other day, and it was a fairly coherent argument, that those massive in-person demonstrations, Malloy, are no longer necessary. As a matter of fact, they're kind of an anachronism in the digital age. There are ways to get the message more powerfully to the people who fund the wars or order the wars than showing up in hundreds of thousands in Washington. Okay, the person who told me this, of course, is of the digital generation. I'm not. I'm from that generation that says you put the feet on the ground, you carry a sign, you scream and chant, and you let the power understand that you are not going to take it anymore. Isn't that funny? Isn't that quaint? Doesn't that sound like something from, the 19th century maybe? Okay, the 20th century? Early? Huh? Show up? Demonstrate? Carry a sign? Oh my God, really? Is that what you folks did, Uncle Mike? You mean you actually did, you got banners? Yeah, that's what we did. And we all know how effective it was. Some people will say it was very effective. Once enough young white Americans in the middle class started to die in the jungles of Vietnam, it became very effective. But that's not what we have now. We have a different situation. So maybe my young friend was entirely correct that hundreds of thousands of people stomping across the or through the streets of Washington, D.C. may not be all that effective or necessary anymore. I don't know. But there are things that we can do, and I hope we're going to do them. All right, stick around. We shall return after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Is the IR.
Seven past the hour, this is the Malloy Show. From the Jerusalem Post, a quote, U.S. may be planning to bomb Iran, end quote. They're quoting a different source. According to the Jerusalem Post, the U.S. could be in the process of accelerating provisions for a possible attack on Iran, according to an ABC News report published Tuesday. The report cited a recent Pentagon decision to push for funding to build, quote, a gargantuan bunker-busting bomb called the Massive Ordnance Penetrator. Originally planned for use in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon's 2009 request, which was approved last week, was published by ABC as well as the previous 2007 request. To explain why the bomb was needed at this juncture, the Pentagon only said, quote, the department has an urgent operational need. That's a military term, a UON. For the capability to strike hard and deeply buried targets in high threat environments. (sighs) The MOP, the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, is the weapon of choice to meet the requirements of the UON, the Urgent Operational Need, end quote. ABC noted that the department which requested the MOP had responsibility over North Korea and Iran. The report also stated this weapon would be, quote, ideally suited, end quote, for a strike on Iran's uranium enrichment plant at Natanz, or the recently revealed plant at Qom. U.S. aerospace manufacturer and defense contractor McDonnell Douglas, received a $52 million contract to build the four MOPs, the report said. $52 million. What is that? $13 million per MOP, Massive Ordnance Penetrator. Son of a bitch. We just, we're just going to keep doing this, aren't we? Huh? Massive Ordnance Penetrator. Meanwhile, here at home, in Detroit today, word went out that there was some federal money available. It is through the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Program. And according to the AP, scuffles erupted as several thousand. I have heard it was 35,000 people showed up. If you saw the video, masses of people in the streets in downtown Detroit as these people jockeyed, pushed, and shoved to get free money being offered to only 3,500 of the city's recently or soon to be homeless. According to the AP, several received medical treatment for fainting or exhaustion while frantically trying to obtain the application for federal housing assistance. The long lines and short tempers highlighted the frustration and desperation that Detroit residents feel struggling through an economic nightmare. Have you been following? You know what Time Magazine has done? They've bought a house in the inner city of Detroit. And they are staffing it with their writers and photographers and editors. And over the course of a year, they're going to be reporting from Detroit. It is just horrifying. When I was a kid growing up, Detroit was the mecca of that part of the Midwest. It wasn't Chicago, it was Detroit. And when I see the pictures of Detroit now, it's a real heartbreaker. The line around Cobo Center, a downtown convention center, started forming well before daybreak. Anger flared within a few hours as more people sought out a dwindling number of applications, for Christ's sake. Applications for the program. Members of the Detroit Police Department's gang squad and other tactical units were called in for crowd control. Several people reportedly passed out from exhaustion had to be treated by emergency medical personnel. Minor injuries reported, no arrests made. Karen Dumas, the communications director for the new mayor there, Dave Bing, said, quote, it's a sign of the times, and we can't deny we have people here who are in need. It's scary, and it's very disappointing. It also shows a need for redirection for our city, end quote. Ms. Dumas, don't be a jerk. Redirection for your city. I think it's a little bit bigger than that, but okay. You know what the unemployment rate in Detroit is? It's approaching 35%. Can you believe that? And if you factor in the people who are underemployed or the people who are working part-time jobs, I guess that's underemployment, and not even making enough to pay rent, hence these programs, you say, the underemployment rate in Chicago or in Detroit is approaching, I've been told, 60%. The city's home foreclosure rate continues to be among the nation's highest. One in four families and three out of every 10 individuals live below the poverty level, according to the U.S. Census. Now, before today, Detroit planning and development workers had spent 2 days handling long lines at City Hall and other locations. Rumors that $3,000 stimulus checks from the Obama administration caused these heavy turnouts. Of course, it was not true. ...33-year-old William Lambert went to City Hall yesterday. Lambert said he is out of work, living with his girlfriend at her mother's home. He said, quote, "We kind of fell on hard times. It's hard working as a carpenter and then not working at all. Things are not good right now," end quote. Another person, a woman, 56, said, quote, "I'm here to meet a need so I won't become homeless and my utilities will be paid. With this economy, I'm not able to keep my head above water," end quote. The city distributed more than 50,000 applications for the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Program over the past several days before running out Wednesday morning. Only 3,500 people who qualify will receive the money, a maximum of $3,000 per applicant. 50,000 applied or got the applications. To be considered, applicants must have lived in Detroit for the past 6 months. Been homeless at one point within the past year and be of low to moderate income. The maximum annual income for an eligible family of four is $35,500, which is way above what a person would make if they were working for minimum wage. You do understand that, right? Okay. Individuals and families meeting the income criteria and facing eviction or foreclosure also are eligible. Being able to maintain housing after getting the assistance also is a condition of the program. So you can't just show up and you're desperate. Your utilities are about to be turned off. You're about to be evicted because you can't pay the rent, or you're about to be foreclosed on because you can't make the mortgage payment. And you have to show the program administrators through this application that if given the money, you will be able to continue to maintain. So that's a catch 22, 23, 24, and 25, isn't it? The deadline to submit these applications, which was today, has been extended a week because of, quote, the enormous number, end quote, distributed. A psychology professor at Wayne State University in Detroit said, quote, "With the economy tanking, homelessness is going to rise. There are so many people who are near homelessness and so many more just a hair away from it." We'll be back.
Ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. A couple emails here. This is from Steve. Mike, you bring up tonight the central question, how can we decide anything based on what is right, what is needed, what is right? Like rebuilding the entire rail system of the United States to support its ports, the distribution, the high-speed passenger and freight, and the need for separate freight and passenger rail beds. An investment of $100 billion into a new rail system would save this country trillions, making our transportation, distribution of products, movement of passengers and freight and hazardous materials would all be more efficient and would make more make our economy more competitive. Like health care, like our hospitals, like investment in clean food and clean environment, or just investment in good sidewalks. But something gets in the way of all this. It is a military that is independent of our government and of our people, a military about to murder more people in Asia for nothing, and testing weapons on the moon before those weapons are tested on people. The present Pentagon budget is over $1.1 trillion in a budget that spends less than $4 trillion. 25% of all tax dollars are going to war and killing and murder, covert and overt. And some of that money is corrupting the Democratic Party. How can Democrats vote against single-payer health care? I keep seeing one business after another going bankrupt. Millions of people hardly have enough to eat or enough to save their home. And yet we have enough to spend our health care money on dropping bombs on people who are sleeping in their beds at home in their own countries. That is what we're good at. Killing women and children in their beds all over the world. Vietnam, Gaza, Iraq, Honduras, Korea, Panama, Chile, Iran. We're even dropping bombs on villages from flying robot drones. It is one war crime after another. We have lived through our 18-year-olds murdering old men and women and children in Vietnam. How many old women lost their lives for waking up in their own beds? How many more tomorrow in Afghanistan or Pakistan? How many more little girls in Ohio and Iowa and New Jersey become orphans and never have known their fathers? For what? Are the body bags still coming home? For what? We can't build a car that runs on solar power, but we can kill a million people in a flash with one nuclear submarine and its 16 nuclear warheads. Why? There's no Congress, not unless you want it, not unless you want it to end, but when? Do we need to kill more Afghanistan women and call them insurgents? Or young men with no jobs? How many more? Signed, Steve the Banker. You know Steve, he calls here a lot. Are you nervous about all this? Are you still listening to the program, or have you bailed out? Well, I guess if you bailed out, you can't answer. But,
Were you talking to me?
No, I know you've bailed out. Christ, you have to live with me. I know how often you hear this stuff.
Was I supposed to listen?
No, you don't have to listen. You really don't. You really don't. Did any of you all see Charlie Wilson's War? Do you know what that's about? Okay. If you saw the movie, you know what it's about. And if you didn't see it, you ought to. Got an email from Bob. It's not a moment with Bob. It's just an email. He writes, dissonant thoughts. Oh, hell, we'll just do what everybody said we should do before the election. Remember, if Obama should deviate from good liberal progressive goals, we're supposed to hold his feet to the fire. Remember that dumbass phrase? Sounds like we hold some sort of leverage, doesn't it? Nah. We spent 8 goddamn years writing and calling. That result, zero. And as Kurt Vonnegut said, referring to the noxious stew in Vietnam so many years ago, quote, when it became obvious what a dumb and cruel and spiritually and financially and militarily ruinous mistake our war in Vietnam was, every artist worth a damn in this country, every serious writer, painter, stand-up comedian, musician, actor, and actress, you name it, came out against the thing. We formed what might be described as a laser beam of protest, with everybody aimed in the same direction, focused and intense. This weapon proved to have the power of a banana cream pie 3 feet in diameter when dropped from a stepladder 5 feet high. End quote. Here's something for liberals and progressives to look forward to. How many of us are ready to protest against the first African-American president? Doesn't that just shrivel a so-called liberal concept of what is appropriate? Certainly sets us up for some liberal dissonance, doesn't it? Remember all those African-American folks who voted for hope and change, and now they'll see us protesting against the man that represented their hope? Fun stuff looming for liberal progressive folk. Truth? A national strike is the first step. All we have to do is figure out how to pull it off. And I've been thinking about it. It's really hard. But I can hear them all.
to border and coast to coast, The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse. You better stop the thing
that you do. I said, oh, watch out. It's 25 before the hour. Quick email here, and then we're going to do some phone calls. The number is 877-996-2556. Hi, Mike. Just asking, last report, Russian Atomic Energy Agency. This is kind of difficult English. It's from Igor and then the last name. Just asking, last report, Russian Atomic Energy Agency showed if Israel and U.S. start bombing Iran nuclear plants, the result will be 25 times worse than Chernobyl tragedy. Rows of winds, the direction of winds in this region, north, northwest. It means Russian cities of Krasnodar, Rostov, Astrakhan will take nuclear dirty bomb 25 times more than Chernobyl. It will affect 25 million population. What do you think Russians will do? Best regards, Igor, in his last name. Well, I kind of don't like to think about that, what the Russians will do, what the Pakistanis will do, what the Israelis will do, what the Obama administration will do, yada, yada, Jesus. Shane is listening on Sirius. Hey, Shane.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I have a different twist on the Afghan war, what's happening now. I think that what's going on now, this pressure on Barack Obama, is going to force someone to bring up the draft, an idea for a draft. I think it's going to go through, and I think he's going to escalate the war. He's not going to send 40,000 troops. He's going to send a lot more than that. And I think it's going to escalate into something bigger than Vietnam, perhaps another world war in that area, especially when Israel and the United States do start bombing with their air force. Going to be a bloodbath over there. And what's worse, at home, I think the civil unrest will be worse than the 60s here, only because this generation, like my children and below, born in the 70s and 80s, were raised on a lot more violence in TV, video games, and disconnected type of social behavior. So I think the civil unrest will be much worse.
Well,
what do you think of that positive overview?
It's almost as positive as some of mine. A couple of comments here, Shane. First of all, I think a forced conscription, if that's not redundant, forced military service, the idea of it, a draft, is about the only thing that's going to motivate this country to do something about these wars of opportunity that are ordered up by corporate America. I think it's a good idea to begin the process of a draft because I think it'll wake people up. As it stands right now, the only people who even know we're in a war are the people whose sons and husbands and daughters and wives and children come home in boxes or come home grievously wounded. The rest of us just look the other way. The rest of and that's by design. The corporate power that runs this country did not want us to see the results of what they're doing by ordering the attacks on these countries. And, of course, the Bush administration being just, very malleable for corporate America went along with it. That's A. B, I don't think there's any such thing as another world war, especially confined to any area of the country. Once it starts, it's not going to stop. And everybody is going to die. I mean, that sounds like a Monty Python skit, doesn't it? But I don't know how you begin a war in that part of the country. I'm sorry, that part of the globe. It's chock-a-block with suicide bombers who don't see nuclear annihilation as a bad thing. They see it as a blessing. So when you have folks who look at their own lives that way or other human lives that way, there's no such thing as mutual assured destruction. The only reason that worked for the Americans and the Russians over 50 years is because Americans and Russians weren't dedicated to their cause to the extent that they were willing to strap explosives on their bodies and blow people up. But once you get to that point, there's no way. I mean, this is a part that that drives me crazy sometimes. When you have an adversary who is not just willing to die, but sees his own death or her own death as a step to paradise, as a good thing, then there's no way you can fight that if your society preaches or teaches that human life should not be used that way. So there is no way to win. There is no way possible to win against a so-called insurgency. Of course, it's their country. I don't know why we call it an insurgency. It's their country. Are they screwed up? In my opinion, they are. I think Taliban are just like Catholic priests. They preach the same thing. Believe what we believe or your ass is going to burn forever. So, there's no difference to me whatsoever. If the people want to rise up against the Catholic Church, they'll do so. If the people want to rise up against the Taliban, they'll do so. Or not. But, you know my feeling. As far as unrest here at home, I don't think we need to get involved in a war for that. That's coming. That is on the horizon. It's very close. We're seeing the trailers of that movie now when we see the free medical services go out to various cities and set up their tents. And you have thousands of people show up for medical service, thousands of people, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Latino, it doesn't make any difference. People who are desperate for medical care and can't get it. When you have applications for some assistance from the government being handed out in a city like Detroit, and you got 3,500 available slots, and you have 50,000 people show up and to secure an application, we're right there. I mean, we're there. The only thing it's going to take is a triggering event. And the right-wing crazy Nazis in this country understand that. Their triggering event, what they want to see, is Obama assassinated. That's what Limbaugh and Beck and Hannity and Savage and Crazy Eyes Malkin and all these right-wingers, this is what they want. This is what they're hoping for, that they can inspire somebody to take a weapon and kill Barack Obama. And if that happens, then they get exactly what they want, and that is a total implosion in this country. Now, if that happens, then our so-called adversaries, the nations around the world who are sick to death of being having their backs stepped on by American corporatism, then they will make their move. And this country is going to become, a tar pit, a hole, a garbage dump. So you bring up some good issues, Shane, you really do. But I think they're going to occur in a different sort of scenario. I sometimes hope for the beginnings of legislation necessary to bring in universal conscription, because if that happens, the American people will then finally, I think, wake up to what's going on. Maybe not. You know, I may be completely wrong. Completely wrong. Jason is in St. Louis listening on Sirius. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm a first-time caller. I love your show. I've been listening to Bobby back from Minneapolis, and it kept me company on a dark highway between Iowa City and St. Louis, so thanks for that.
Well, glad to be along for the ride.
I got something for you that I'm sure you'll have lots of comments about. Years ago, my grandfather died, who was a World War II vet. I started learning pretty do a lot of research and reading about World War II, and that led me into reading about things like the military-industrial complex, all of our proxy wars, Vietnam, Korea, you named several of them, Panama, Grenada, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And the one thing is a 36-year-old who has not served in the military, but certainly is a relatively a master's degree. I'm a fairly bright guy. There's no doubt that since World War II, history has definitely repeated itself. We've had an enemy. We've had to do something about it. We ramp up this stuff. The national flag goes up, and lo and behold, oops, we made a mistake. Well, and then 20 years later, the pattern repeats. And then 10 years later, the pattern repeats, et cetera.
Right.
So corollary to that, I read not too long ago an article in, of all places, Playboy, which actually does have good articles.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a satire, but the guy meant it. He's basically, the article said, what would it take for there to be a real revolt in this country? And the example he used was, what if President Bush got up and said, guys, you're right, I admit it, we let 9/11 happen. He said, more than likely, people would you know, they'd sound on the talk shows, and you'd have all kinds of public backlash. But the author of the story said, would people really do anything? And I guess that's an issue I kind of want to see what you think is, what would it really take for people to really, really mm-hmm. do something? It just seems like our this pattern repeats itself, and we keep getting hacked away at, and you know, trillions of dollars are given away to companies, finance companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'll tell you, and Jason, we got a break here. Listen, thanks, pal. Let me try to answer that when we come back after this break. What would happen in this country if former President Bush, or Cheney or somebody in that administration stood up and said, "Yeah, we let that happen deliberately and specifically." Let me try to answer that. We'll be right back.
Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
10 before the hour. What would happen if Bush or somebody, would that be enough to motivate the American people to do something if Bush or one of these other fascist sons of bitches, stated categorically, yeah, we know it was going to happen, or yeah, we'd let it happen. You know what my feeling is? No. No. And I'll tell you why. Because the airwaves are blanketed with neo-Nazi garbage from everybody from Crazy Eyes Malkin all the way down into the sewer of Glenn Beck. And they do a very effective job at keeping everything tamped down. Now, I realize what David Brooks wrote in the New York Times last week. I even read it on the program where he said these people are not effective in getting anything done. Their purpose is not to get things done. I would disagree in that manner with David Brooks. Their function is to keep everything diverted, to keep things tamped down, to provide protection or diversion from the sons of bitches that are ruining the country, destroying the country, killing the country, murdering the country, and they do a very good job of it. So, if word got out, or if not word got out, but if Bush, went to University of Texas or Texas A&M and stood up at the podium and fessed up, I think there would be a shudder and a moan, and then immediately, right-wing talk radio and talk television would kick into gear and explain to the dumbass American people that, yes, it was a terrible admission, and yes, perhaps George Bush did something bad, but you know what? Had he not done that, had he not allowed 9/11 to happen, the American people never would have been motivated to invade Iraq and Afghanistan, and God knows, if we hadn't invaded Iraq and Afghanistan right now, the Iraqis and the Afghans would be running the country. They would have military patrols on every street corner. They would be in the halls of Congress. There would have been no elections. So thank God. There's what you need to do, American people, is thank God George Bush engineered that. And that would fly. And you know why it would fly? Because we are anesthetized in this country. We are controlled, and we are. You know, if you first destroy the economy and make it impossible for the quickest way to I dropped my microphone. The quickest way to implement dictatorship is to destroy the middle class. The quickest way to ensure the continuation of the dictatorship is to make sure that the middle class does not come back, because revolution, and we've talked about this before, always arises from the middle class. If there's no middle class, no revolution. If there is no middle class, there is no move. Leaders do not emerge who will overthrow a dictatorship. Now, by middle class, I mean a vibrant, healthy, strong middle class, one that has those accoutrements that are associated with the middle class. You take a look at revolution around the planet. I don't care if it was Castro or Lenin or Mao or George Washington or the people that led the French Revolution or Jose Marti. It doesn't make any difference. Go to Africa, go to Asia. You will see that people who lead revolutions come from the middle class. So you can't destroy every single potential revolutionary. You destroy the middle class, and then they don't arise. So the middle class is being destroyed in this country. It's been an ongoing process ever since 1980, since the election of Ronald Reagan. An absolute destruction of the class of people, the economic class of people, from which revolution always arises. Once you destroy that, then you're home free. If your goal and the goal of the corporatists is to completely dominate the political system, to become a dictatorship over the American people, if that is your goal, then the first objective is to destroy the fertile field, if you will, from which revolution always arises. So what would the American people do on finding out that George W. Bush was a mass killer and who had led us into this situation deliberately? There are probably millions of people who already believe that. And some of us have made efforts to prosecute George W. Bush or to bring that to people's attention. And there's no response. There's no response. I cannot enter a courtroom and prosecute George W. Bush. You have to be a prosecutor to do that. And all the prosecutors who were given a roadmap on how to do that, thanks to Vince Bugliosi and Bob Alexander, have refused. Utterly. Absolutely. Nope. Sorry. Not going to happen. So, I think that the quick answer to your question is what would happen to the American people if they knew the truth? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. There might be a little bit of grumbling. There might be a little of quick intake of breath. Oh, no. Really? Oh, Jesus. Well, oh, my God. Well, what do you want to do? Nothing. Shh. Be quiet. Be quiet. I've got to go find a job anyway. Oh, man, I knew it would come to this, didn't you? Yeah, yeah, I knew it too. Well, what do we do? Nothing, man. That, you know, it happened 9 years ago. You know, damage has been done. Yeah, but besides, we have a new president. Don't worry about it. Jesus, God, I wish I would have known this 4 years ago, right? Yeah, me too. Yeah, then we would have done something, right? Oh, yeah, would have done something then. But there's no point in doing anything now. No, I know. Can you believe that, though? Well, I always knew it. I always knew it. Well, what do you think of what Limbaugh said? Well, he's right. You know, if we wouldn't have had that happen, then how, you know. Well, Beck said it, too. There would have been Iraqi soldiers all over the place. I know. God damn. I don't know. Welcome back to the Molloy program. At the bottom of this hour, we will have Uncle Mike's Story Corner. It is not real long tonight, but it's a goodie. So stick around for that. Uncle Mike's Story Corner tonight in about half an hour. Back to your phone calls for a while here. Brent is in Ottawa, Illinois, listening on XM. Hey, Brent.
How you doing, Mike?
All right. How are you?
Not too bad. And I will have to agree with you on your previous, whatever you want to call that, about the American public would just probably just sit back and just, if they found out that Bush or Cheney or whoever had anything to do with 9/11, they probably just, I don't think anybody would really do anything. But
no.
what I really want to talk about is,
okay,
you know, where we're at right now. I mean, this has been a long train wreck happening. And it started basically back in the 70s and the 80s when our economic trade policy switched. We went from a country where we used to make things to where now we're a service-based economy. And everybody's been, they've been preaching that, you know, oh, hey, it's going to be so much better and this and that and whatever. And we basically shipped every manufacturing job that paid a decent wage to some third world country to work. Now we have people here. We're a third world country. You got areas of this country that have been a third world country for 20, 30 years. I mean, I live in an area where, you know what? The manufacturing jobs here, they went away. They're not here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want a decent job, you have to get in a car and you have to travel.
Right.
I mean, I work in downtown Chicago. I live 86 miles from downtown Chicago. I have a 2-hour commute
Wow.
to go to work every day to get a decent job.
Good God.
And,
86 miles each
yeah.
way. Oh, man.
But the thing about it is, I mean, that's my choice, yeah, that I live here. I mean, there's other reasons why I live here. But, I mean, I know people that, you know, it's similar story in this. Where I live, it's
mm-hmm.
like you don't work in this town.
Right.
You have to go somewhere else to get a job. And it's like that all over the Midwest. And the people talk about how great the 80s and the 90s were for people, but I got news for you. Yeah, for certain people it was really great. But for a lot of people it hasn't been.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've been going down the economic ladder instead of going up. I mean, instead of making, you know, the good money working for GM or Ford or Chrysler or whoever, now they're working for some other company for a third
mm-hmm.
of what they used to make. And they have hardly any benefits if that. And then the thing about it is they look at the other people that still have something and they're like, well, you know, hey, what are you complaining about?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, we need, I mean, and part of this, you know, I'm really curious because you just had an ad on for day trading. You know, I mean, is that where we're going?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. I mean, I'm not bad rapping your sponsor or whatever, but it's just kind of like, you know what? Hey, only so many people can make a living day trading.
Well, just for clarification, Brent, that probably was not my ad, so to speak.
Well, I know. I'm just saying. I just heard it.
Yeah, because you know, we let me just share this with you. We own the Molloy Broadcasting program. Owns about 5 minutes an hour of advertising. The rest of it is put up there by XM or Sirius or whatever radio station you're listening, and even some internet. Well, do we own the internet ads, Kathy? I think most of them. So people hear ads on this, while you're listening to my program, you may hear an ad from some right-wing organization. That's not because I've taken a dime from them. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, I'm not trying to say that you are, but I'm just saying.
Oh, no. I understand. I just wanted to clarify that point.
But here's what I want to point out though, is the fact that, you know, this country, and you talk about the middle class. The revolution starts from the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the period after the World War II, when, you know, this country had this pent-up demand, you're coming out of the Depression, coming out of World War II, and manufacturing businesses were just churning out everything,
mm-hmm.
you know, everything under the sun, from refrigerators to
right.
TVs to cars and whatever. I mean, things were rolling good. And, I mean, everybody was making money, and everybody was, you know, everybody was improving. Everybody was having their boats raised.
Right,
you know,
right.
All, you know, that old phrase, you know, the everybody's boats rise and whatever. But now it seems like the corporate policy anymore is it's on profit. And the only way you can increase profit anymore is to cut the cost of that input. And it's to cut the biggest way you cut that input is to cut the cost of labor. And it's like these corporate bean counters and wherever they be, they're looking at it and say, you know what, hey, I can pay someone in the Midwest or on the West Coast or East Coast or whatever to make that product. Or I can pick that factory up and I can send it to Mexico or South America or Malaysia or China or wherever.
Right, right, right. And Brent, I got to interrupt because I'm going to have to move on here. But you're absolutely right. And you've pretty much got the time frame right, too, I think, 70s, 80s. We've had Reagan, Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. And the goal of all these people were to destroy, absolutely, utterly destroy the middle class, destroy the ability of Americans to make a living, and they've done a fairly good job at it. So thanks, I appreciate you checking in. Michael is in Baltimore, listening on XM. Michael, welcome to the program.
How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Good. I have a question about your philosophy on socialism versus capitalism. I'm trying to understand what your position is. I don't quite understand it.
Democratic socialist. I believe in the excuse me, sort of the Jeffersonian model, but without the slavery. Jefferson believed in small businesses, family-owned farms. Of course, the labor was all provided by slaves, but he had kind of the right idea. A democratic socialism simply says that there are certain key industries, in my mind, that would be banking, energy, healthcare, transportation, and the production of weapons that should be run by the government. They pretty much are now, but they're disguised. We have middlemen. The weapons industry is run by the government. McDonnell Douglas does not say, I think I will build a bunker buster bomb. The Pentagon asks McDonnell Douglas to do that and then pays them trillions of dollars to do it. So capitalism is anti-family. It's anti-life. It is extremely oppressive. Socialism, democratic socialism, believes that everybody should really have a chance. Nobody should starve. Nobody should be homeless. Nobody should go without medical care. And that you shouldn't wage war on your neighbors. You just shouldn't do that in order to steal their oil or steal their minerals. So I hope that explains it for you. I think your question is more of a challenge, though, than really looking for information.
I'm trying to understand what you would replace the profit motive for with in your democratic socialism.
Say what? Say it again.
What would you replace the profit motive with in your democratic
socialism? I wouldn't replace it. Why replace it? You didn't listen to me. I just said democratic socialism includes small businesses, small family farms. You let the market, you let prices be set by supply and demand. There are certain things that apply in democratic socialism, in a socialist model. I'm not talking about, Soviet socialism. I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about a planned economy, where it comes from the top down. Hell no, that's communism. You're confusing, I think, communism with socialism. I'm not a communist. I think their system sucks as bad as capitalism does. But in a democratic socialist society, with a parliamentary form of government, you have a leadership that has to respond fairly quickly to what the voters want. They're not locked in like our senators are for 6 years. They're not locked in like our representatives are for 2 years. They're not locked in, short of impeachment, like our president is for 4 years. So democratic socialism, I think you are misunderstanding the terms. And what I would suggest, instead of calling me, I just do a little radio talk show host, educate yourself, okay? Learn. Go educate yourself. Don't get it from Glenn Beck or Mike Malloy or Rush Limbaugh. educate yourself. Find out what it is. And you, I think you'd be surprised. It may appeal to you, too.
Go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
It's 21 past the hour. Perhaps another partial answer to the guy who wanted to know why I'm a socialist. And I do believe his definitions are skewed, but that's right. Richard Wolff is the author of a new book called Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. And he said today, according to the Institute for Public Accuracy, the following, which is not unlike what one of our callers said, said tonight. Since the 1970s, U.S. employers stopped paying their workers rising real wages, even as worker productivity kept rising. Over the previous century, U.S. workers' real wages had risen together with their productivity. Workers had two choices. Give up the American dream of sending kids to college, buying good health care, enjoying retirement, living decently, or else borrow to pay for those things. Desperate to live the dream, to be, you know, successful, to do what every advertisement advised, U.S. workers went on a 30-year borrowing binge. First, they borrowed with the collateral on their homes, if they owned homes. When that was not enough, the credit card industry arose to make unsecured consumer loans. By 2006, U.S. workers' families had multiple members working multiple jobs and staggering under mortgage, auto, and credit card loans that their stagnant incomes could no longer sustain. What collapsed in 2008 was an American economy built in good part on a house of credit cards because employers stopped paying rising wages for rising worker productivity. First, credit card companies took advantage of stagnant wages to push credit cards way beyond what working families could sustain. Today, credit card companies are cutting back consumer credit and raising fees to save themselves from financial ruin. The economic crisis, whose recovery requires more spending on goods and services, because that provides jobs, is thus worsened by credit card companies whose actions reduce spending. Meanwhile, real wages are not rising to, once again, relieve workers of the need to borrow. So, unemployment worsens, foreclosures grow, and the underlying causes of the economic crisis go unattended. End quote. Now, for the caller who wanted to know about socialism and wants to know about the profit motive, you know, I could be a smart ass and say, you got to be kidding me. You have to be kidding me. Profit motive for whom? What worker operates within the blessings of the profit motive? Productivity, which should increase profit, has skyrocketed. Wages, which is a definition of profit to the worker, have either stagnated or reversed. And you want to ask me about socialism versus capitalism? Democratic socialism? Are you serious? And the odd part is, yes, the caller was serious. Of course he was serious. And I'm not going to be the typical Mike Malloy smartass answer. I really do believe that if that caller or anyone who has a question about this would just simply educate themselves, even if it means taking a course at a junior college. I don't know how much information, real information, you're going to get online or at websites. You know, I don't know. Everything is weird right now. Maybe self-education, maybe just getting a book. Go to your friendly neighborhood bookstore and find, ask the owner, ask the seller, you know, do you have a book on democratic socialism, either versus capitalism or just on its own, just so I can understand what this freakish talk show host was talking about the other night when he You know, he's talking about he's a democratic socialist. What the hell does that mean? Isn't that communism? Isn't that China? Isn't that Cuba? Isn't that, well, Cuba gets fairly close to it, but Cuba is run by a dictator. I don't care what your feelings are about Cuba or Castro or the revolution or Bautista or the system down there. Castro is a dictator. Let's be real. So many people who claim to be socialists are dictators. Castro's been in power for 40 years in a real, or no, 50 years, 50 years, I think. Yeah, 50 years. In a real democratic socialist state, such a thing would not happen. It's impossible. Because when somebody's in office for 50 years, it can only mean one thing: fraud, lies, deceit. You know, I'm not an admirer of dictators. I don't care if they're on the left. That doesn't mean squat to me. A dictator's a dictator. So I just wish that I wish that people who have honest questions. I don't know if the guy's question was honest or not. I had the feeling it was kind of a challenge, just like the other guy the other night who said, "Well, you believe in what do you answer? You're pro-life, aren't you? You know." Anybody who's pro-life would be working their ass off to end the wars in Vietnam, or end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But most people who claim to be pro-lifers are not. They're no more pro-life than they're Christian. They are not pro-life. They are not Christian. They are manipulative, controlling freaks who have found a catchphrase: "I'm pro-life." No, you're not. You goddamn liar. You're pro-death. And in the meantime, you also want to put women back in their place. Which is to shut up, don't have any control over their own bodies, and certainly not have private conversations with their doctor. Are you kidding me?
Well, you better listen, my sisters and brothers, because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land. And they will till we all come to us.
Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
It is 25 before the hour on the Malloy program, and it's time once again for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Gather around, kiddies. It's a little chilly here in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains tonight, so a perfect night for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Maybe you've got a bowl of popcorn or a big cup of hot chocolate. Tonight's story is called A War of Absurdity by Robert Scheer. Every once in a while, a statistic just jumps out at you in a way that makes everything else you hear on a subject seem beside the point, if not downright absurd. That was my reaction to the recent statement of the president's national security advisor, former Marine General James Jones, concerning the size of the terrorist threat from Afghanistan. Quote, "The Al-Qaeda presence is very diminished. The maximum estimate is less than 100 operating in the country, no bases, no ability to launch attacks on either us or our allies." End quote. Less than 100. And he's basing his conservative estimate on the best intelligence data available to our government. That means that Al-Qaeda, for all practical purposes, does not exist in Afghanistan. So, why are we having a big debate about sending even more troops to fight an enemy that has relocated elsewhere? Because of the blind belief in the minds of those like John McCain, determined to win in Afghanistan, that if we don't escalate, Al-Qaeda will inevitably come back. Why? It's not like Al-Qaeda is an evil weed indigenous to Afghanistan and dependent on its climate and soil for survival. Its members were foreign imports in the first place, recruited by our CIA to fight the Soviets because there were evidently not enough locals to do the job. After all, U.S. officials first forged the alliance between the foreign fighters and the Afghan Mujahideen, who morphed into the Taliban, and we should not be surprised that that tenuous alliance ended. The Taliban and other insurgents are preoccupied with the future of Afghanistan, while the Arab fighters couldn't care less and have moved on to more hospitable climes. There is no indication that any of the contending forces in Afghanistan, including the Taliban, are interested in bringing al-Qaeda back. On the contrary, all the available evidence indicates that the Arab fighters are unwelcome and that it is their isolation from their former patrons that has led to their demise. As such, while one wishes that the Afghan people would put their houses in order, these are not, even after 8 long years of occupation, our houses. Sure, there are all sorts of angry people in Afghanistan, eager to pick fights with each other, and most of all, any foreigners who seem to be threatening their way of life. But why should that any longer have anything to do with us? Even in neighboring Pakistan, the remnants of al-Qaeda are barely hanging on. As the Wall Street Journal reported Tuesday, quote, hunted by U.S. drones, beset by money problems, and finding it tougher to lure young Arabs to the bleak mountains of Pakistan, al-Qaeda is seeing its role shrink there. And in Afghanistan, according to intelligence reports and Pakistan and U.S. officials. For Arab youths who are al-Qaeda's primary recruits, it's not romantic to be cold and hungry and hiding, said a senior U.S. official in South Asia, end quote. It's time to declare victory and begin to get out, rather than descend deeper into an intractable civil war that we will neither comprehend nor in the end will care much about. Terrorists of various stripes will still exist as they have throughout history, but the ones we are most concerned about have proved mighty capable of relocating to less hostile environments, including sunny San Diego and southern Florida, where the 9/11 hijackers had no trouble fitting in. There is a continued need for effective international police work to thwart the efforts of a widely dispersed al-Qaeda network, but putting resources into that effort does not satisfy the need of the military establishment for a conventional field of battle. That is the significance of General Stanley McChrystal's leaked report calling for a massive counterinsurgency campaign to make everything right about life in Afghanistan down to the governance of the most forlorn village. The general's report aims not at eliminating al-Qaeda, which he concedes is barely existent in the country, but rather at creating an Afghan society that is more to his own liking. It is a prescription, as the Russians and others before them learned, for war without end. That might satisfy the marketing needs of the defense industry and the career hopes of select military and political aspirants, but it has nothing to do with fighting terrorism. In the end, it would seem that some of our leaders need the Afghanistan battleground more than the terrorists do. Another episode of Uncle Mike's Story Corner brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight's episode written by Robert Shear of TruthDig.com and entitled A War of Absurdity. Uncle Mike's Story Corner will return.
It's a beautiful day
someday.
In this neighborhood. A beautiful day for a neighbor.
Oh my God. He's dead, isn't he? He is, isn't he? Not Robert Shear. It is about 19 before the hour. Nora is in Minneapolis listening on KTNF. Hey, Nora.
Hey, I was calling about Afghanistan because not that I know anything about it. I wouldn't even try really to know something about it. But this guy named Rory Stewart, he seems to be a Brit, and he was on public television twice, and he's in there. His project is called Turquoise Mountain in Kabul. They employ people there, like, doing handcrafts and stuff. And they've cleared 17,000 trucks of garbage. That's why I believe him. But what he says, Rory Stewart, he wrote a book called The Places in Between. His advice is whatever America and Obama decide what it is that they're going to do there, they have to be ready to do it for 20 to 30 years or more, whatever it is. If they really think they're there to try to help and develop and educate or do whatever it is that the people of Afghanistan need, they need to do it for 20 to 30 years or more, whatever it is they decide.
Right. Well, the obvious and demonstrable arrogance of our activities in these countries, based on the insistence of corporate America, is it's so galling to the rest of the world. And that's one of the reasons I think, thanks, Nora, there's going to be an awful lot of Schadenfreude when the U.S. finally implodes. There are going to be a lot of countries around the globe that are going to say it's about time. It's about time. Your arrogance. You come into our country. You invade us. And your lie is you're going to bring us democracy, or you're going to remove an oppressive left-wing government, while at the same time you support murderous right-wing governments. And you are not interested in democracy or our freedom or justice at all. You're interested in fighting communist expansionism, if it were in the 60, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, or you are interested only in assisting your military-industrial establishment as it continues to be the only profitable thing you ravenous sons of bitches in America produce. Ooh, huh, you think? I think anyone who has some questions about Afghanistan, and I'm surprised Obama has not read dispatches by, I think it was Michael Hare, and things they carried. And I'm drawing a blank on the author's name right now, and I usually don't do an instant Google. Things They Carried is the definitive book, novel. It's a novel on the experiences of soldiers during Vietnam. Things They Carried. Dispatches by Michael Hare is H-E-R-R. Is he the one that wrote that? Again, I'm, you know, pulling this out of my head, and it's late at night. But both of those books, if you are interested in what this president and his military advisors and his so-called foreign policy staff seem to be pointing this nation toward, please read those two books, especially if you are a young man or woman who is seriously thinking about joining the corporatist military. Read Things They Carried. You know, a different generation read Catch 22, or what was the one about Dresden, Kathy? Slaughterhouse 5. Read Things They Carried. Read Dispatches.
Won't you leave me in my misery? Trouble, trouble, please be kind. I don't want no fight, and I haven't got a lot of time.
Ten before the hour, thanks to our crew. Kate Petrini, Bruce Enberg, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Sharon Gordy, Ben Birch, all contribute to this program. Thank you. Kathy Bay is our engineer and executive producer. A couple of quick emails. Thanks to, I have two in my research department now, Reggie and Michael. It was Tim O'Brien who wrote The Things They Carried. And as Michael points out, Tim O'Brien also wrote Going After Cacciato, which also is an amazing book. It is a novel. It gets into, at one point, when Cacciato leaves Vietnam and has decided he's going to walk home, if I remember the novel. And they try to catch him because he's entering into territory that if American soldiers are found there, it's going to be an international incident. But it's a feverish, almost acid trip, sections of it kind of book. It's been years, oh my God, decades since I read those books. But if you get a chance, Dispatches, The Things They Carried, and Going After Cacciato is, just that title. You know, I've forgotten Tim O'Brien wrote Going After Cacciato. Just the title gives me shivers. Man, that was it's really something. Michael, different Michael, in D.C., writes, I listen to KPOJ on the internet, so I'm a couple hours behind. I'm listening to your first hour now. I tend to agree with you, but I keep thinking, this is regarding Afghanistan, I keep thinking how many more girls are going to be burned with acid while trying to go to school? How many couples are going to be buried alive because of forbidden love? I just can't let that go. What can we do about these things? Probably nothing, but aren't we citizens of the world? Aren't we being irresponsible if we see such injustice and do nothing about it? It's so goddamn hard being a liberal. Signed, Michael, and his last name, and his business address, and his cell phone, and his email address. All right, Michael. No, we're not citizens of the world. We never have been. There is no nation that is a citizen of the world. We have had some of our philosophers, our political philosophers, talk about that in kind of a wistful way, but that will never occur. Certainly not until the human race perhaps faces an external threat so massive, whether it is a threat from space, you know, an approaching meteorite or global warming. No, we're not citizens of the world. We are not. How many more girls are going to be burned with acid while trying to go to school? Probably as many as the oppressive sons of bitches in Afghanistan can catch. And you're right, there's nothing we can do about that. How many couples are going to be buried alive because of forbidden love? As many as the oppressive priests can catch. However, as Michael writes, I can't let that go. What can we do about these things? Probably nothing. We have instances in this country of injustice and torture and murder and mayhem decapitations and burnings and attacks on women and doctors and gay folk and people of color and immigrants. We have all that here. So not only are we not citizens of the world, but frankly, we have not been citizens of our own country because of the injustice here. I don't mean to be a Pat Buchanan isolationist. I don't mean to do that at all. But we have so much to deal with here. And if the time ever comes, and I believe that's where our focus should be, end our militarism, end any sort of international armed force that would go to other countries and invade and kill and murder and be killed. Have a National Guard if we need it, which we don't because we have nuclear weapons. But as far as trying to be citizens of the world, would that that day would come, but it will never come because that's what the right wing loves to scream about. Run one worldism! You know. And then they start quoting the Bible that God created the Tower of Babel as proof that he did not want people to be together on anything. You know, so once again, the sickness that is religion is going to seep through any attempt to recognize that the human race is the human race. And, you know, all that stuff you've always read about and heard about, you know, the family of mankind And, you know, why are we just so struggling against each other? Why do we have political denominations? Why do we have separation? Yada, yada, yada. I appreciate your soul, Michael. Your soul certainly is in the right place. Absolutely. But we are not. We simply are not citizens of the world. If we were citizens of the world, if there were any country that was true, a true citizen of the world, it would be trying to save the world. We're not trying to do that. Or not save it, just preserve it. Just make it continue to be livable. Nobody does that. There's a lot of rhetoric about it. But the biggest drag so far has been American predatory capitalism on trying to address the issue of global climate change. We're not citizens of the world. I'm sorry, Michael. I don't mean to be the one to say this to you. We are, we're not even citizens in our own country. That's hard to take, I know. Gordon wants me to remind you it's been 11 years ago today that the comatose and bleeding body of a beautiful young man named Matthew Shepard was tied to a fence with his own shoelaces and left to die. That's something, Michael, that we as citizens of this country would be advised to address if we want to declare ourselves to be moral and just. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.